Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to you, but I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield and we'll see them.
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
The World Service members listening today may remember earlier this year while interviewing Sam Bennett about his green jersey win in the Tour de France. I suddenly seized up with cramps in my legs mid-interview. Thankfully, the man who had just spent the previous 3 weeks cycling thousands of miles up and down mountains didn't notice what was going on the other end of the Skype line. So I got through it with my dignity intact. The chances of me getting through today's podcast without a similar cramp-related incident, however, are very slim indeed. These legs are feeling pretty heavy right now, having spent my bank holiday Sunday running the virtual Dublin Marathon. Welcome to the show. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen. And congratulations on finishing the route. And also, if you do cramp up, under no circumstances, try and hide what pain you're in. I want to actually hear your howls of anguish. In fact, I demand howls of anguish on this show.
Honestly, as I did that intro there, I started feeling something, and I don't know if it was just some sort of I'm putting bad vibes out here. Ken is off today, so Richie is politely laughing along to my marathon tales of woe. How are you, Richie?
How are you, lads? You well?
I was hips forward all the way, guys. You'd be glad to know.
I'm glad to hear it.
What was I hips forward running up Cliney Hill at mile 20? I'm not sure. I did actually start. I had a decision to make coming down from Killiney Hill because I had started cramping in my calf and my hamstring. Is it possible to cramp on the inside of your leg? Like the inside of my leg was seizing up at around mile 21, 22. Oh, things were looking grim. And obviously, I'm luring the energy drink in and energy gels and all sorts. Then, of course, I start getting a massive stitch. You know the way, everyone's played sport through having a little stitch in their side, but it was getting really bad. And I'm like, oh no, I'm having to make a decision here. Do I keep throwing fluids and everything in to try to help out the cramp? But that's probably causing the stitch. What do I choose between here? Eventually the stitch went away. Yeah.
Can I talk to you about another choice that you made, which was running up Killiney Hill at mile 20? I mean, you chose the route. Yeah. Why would you choose to run up a hill after 20 miles of running?
Great question.
It's a great question, Murph. One I have asked myself.
I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
I wanted to remember this. I'm pretty sure I'll remember this for the rest of my life anyway, running a bloody marathon on my own in the middle of a pandemic. My wife and child randomly popping up down on Dunleary Pier with a well done daddy poster, all this kind of stuff. There was a lot of lovely moments, a couple of friends dotted around as well.
I could have run you over in my car and you would have remembered it for the rest of your life. I mean, at some stage you have to say, like, did you want to break your personal best or were you just after the participation medal alone? You had a shot. I was following you. I checked in like 3 times and I was like, he's flying it. He's absolutely flying it. Maybe my maths were wrong, but it seemed to me around you were about 60% of the way through the marathon and you were like, I felt you were going to break 3 hours, 41 minutes. I mean, that's what I felt in my heart. I felt you had a shot at it. So I feel cheated. Your fans feel cheated by this Killiney Hill omni-shambles.
Are my many legions of fans not way more impressed with me taking on such a unique challenge of running up a hill. Bear in mind the elevation, right? The elevation of my run overall was 100 feet. The elevation at mile 20 was 450 something feet. Just this massive incline. The problem is, you have to actually, to run up Killiney Hill, right? You actually have to run up, well, the angle I came from, well, I suppose any angle you come from, you have to run up a good few hills to get to Killiney Hill to then run up it. That's your issue, you know, if it's just one
this
small
is ridiculous.
Hill.
Okay. But Murph, it's absolutely like, ridiculous.
At the risk of being a running bore, Murph, I'm actually chalking that down as possibly my best marathon. Yes, I could have had a go at the personal best and I chose not to. I feel running 3 hours 53, which I did yesterday, and taking in that route is more impressive than if I'd run 3 hours 41 and broken my personal best.
Listen, you were afraid to go for the personal best, so you invented this hill towards the end of the run to ensure that this is a chalk and cheese comparison. Instead of being honest enough with yourself to say, can I beat my personal best?
Richie, this is the kind of crap I put up with. Surely a fellow elite athlete like yourself will appreciate what I did.
I'm finding it very difficult to identify with you. If I drive 10 minutes in the car, my back is sore afterwards. We're in different worlds in terms of what our bodies can do. I'd agree with Murph. Like, it does seem like there's a little bit of fear of failure there, that you chose a route which you were guaranteed to be able to come out at the end and pat yourself on the back. Why not push yourself and measure yourself? I'm listening to you, and basically you're giving yourself kind of credit for just running up a hill. No mention of speed or the time taken. So, I did think when I hear you speak about being a marathon runner that there was a competitive streak in you, or that you push yourself, but it sounded like yesterday you were just there for a Sunday jog.
Anything guaranteed when I was running up and down, I actually thought there might be a fear of completely melting down, which didn't happen. But listen, I've got my running community, I've got a lot of Second Captains World Service members getting in touch with me and indeed Monday Only listeners on Twitter and all the rest, so I'm going to take their congratulations of any respect from my colleagues.
Owen, can I just say I've got a lot of respect for you.
Owen, I like you and I like your style,
and congratulations once again on competing marathon. It's something that I will never be able to do, so congrats. And well done, Owen. And I mean that sincerely, okay? I just want to put that on the record.
Amazing. Owen, you're amazing.
I prefer the earlier stuff, actually. But thanks very much, guys. And thanks to all the World Service members and Monday Only listeners who got in touch. You brought up a word there. I think it was Richie who brought up. Fear. Fear. And that was the word that dominated the post-match narrative around the Manchester United-Chelsea game, which featured this amazing feud, apparently, between Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink and Patrice Evra. Patrice Evra, right, has been running his mouth for a lot of this season. But did he finally meet his match? I'll play a clip in a moment, Richie, but you were the one who you were banging down my door wanting to talk about this today.
Oh, it was brilliant. And it was really welcome after a game which had one of the most lowest entertainment ratings you could possibly give a fixture, particularly one involving two teams like Man United and Chelsea. But I was kind of almost envious of the position they were in some way. They just had so much uninterrupted time to discuss what they had just watched. And so many times you're in a TV studio, you're confined to maybe not just a limited amount of time, but there's so many other things that have to be brought in. You have to break for an ad. There's a post-match interview with the man of the match or a manager. There's analysis pieces which have to be shown before you get to the end. And these two were just allowed give an opinion and go back and forth. It was clearly, probably they could sense during the second half that the producer or Kelly Kate sitting there going, okay, these guys don't need much direction. They don't need to be prodded along, or they just leave them off. And it was brilliant. It was so entertaining. And they were making really, really good points as well. It wasn't just the way in which they were delivering it, or the little bit of needle, friendly needle that was there. What they were saying was really, really interesting to listen to.
It was. Yeah, so essentially, it boiled down to Hasselbaink was making the point that this was just a poor game. Everyone knew it was a poor game, but he reckoned that given that United had conceded 6 goals recently and Chelsea have been leaking a lot of goals, essentially both sides can take some positives, you know. Evra didn't hold that view at all. But the problem that Hasselbaink has to take into account here is when you really needle Patrice Evra, you must prepare for the consequences.
Look, and we're going to create more chances.
I understand. Do I agree? No. I understand why Man United, but also Chelsea, why they have done what they have done. Do I understand? Yes. Do I agree? I want to see goals. I'm sitting here. I want to talk about goals. You know, we want to talk about goals.
It's
not
about
analyze.
The goal as well.
And about,
it's
good
about
football.
Passing. Passing the ball in the right. You can see people were scared to pass the ball today. Don't tell me that. It's not about goal. I didn't want United to win like 3-4-0 today.
Scared is a big word.
Is the truth.
No, scared.
Because you don't want to say.
Scared is a big word.
Is the truth. Come on, come on, Jimmy. Jimmy, you remember my 9 stitches I have in my leg? Because these guys, you know, they broke my. You don't remember 2004 against Chelsea? I can show it. You can zoom on my ankle. I've got 9 stitches because this guy is always smiling, but you go hard on me. Did I finish the game?
I don't know.
Did we beat you? Yes, of course. Sorry, my friend.
What are you talking about? You don't remember 2004, Jimmy? 9 stitches in my leg? Oh, this guy. Ever's mad.
He is, yeah. He's a madman. And, you know, I think there might be, you know, maybe there's a limited enough shelf life to have a madman on your Premier League coverage. But as of right now, you know, he is delivering the goods on a pretty regular basis.
he was great. I did fear for him a little bit when he kind of made the loose comment before the Palace match a few weeks ago about Wilf Zaha. I thought, okay, I don't know if being that loose and that flippant and not having the sense to know that there's just some areas you just can't bring into a studio on live TV. You just can't. And for him to say that, I thought, oh, I wonder will this fella be back again? Yeah. But there's a you're kind of drawn to him at this stage. I know, like, even at the start of the game beforehand, he was asked about the team selection, and he just basically said, you know, we're behind the manager, we trust him. Like, again, this kind of adopting this position of a fan as opposed to an impartial pundit. And even about recent results, he just said of the players, you know, I'm proud of them. Again, not being an objective observer. And I thought, okay, that might be a bit tiring after a while, but forget about all that, all the other stuff he brings to the studio. I think it's great. I could watch the fella all day long.
Yeah, one final point on that. We'll get into maybe the substance of their arguments with Jonathan Wilson in a little while. But one final point to raise is Kelly Cates there did an unbelievable job. There was at one point, I counted from the start, there's a 15-minute clip that people can watch on YouTube if you missed it. It's very entertaining stuff. She went through the first 6 minutes without saying a word. I mean, that is not what a lot of TV presenters would do in that situation. So I thought that was top stuff.
Richie, I'm kind of interested in what you say there. Like, is time actually the big enemy of punditry on television?
It's always the first question I ask, even before we show up and before in the pre-show meeting. It's like, how much studio talk time do we have? So I know what time we go on air and what time kickoff is at, but when you factor in ads or the time where you're obliged to go over to the stadium at, and all the other things, like there might be a competition, there might be a pre-recorded interview, so you have to whittle down to how much time. So, like, even like we might go on air at 7:30 for a Champions League match, which mightn't start at 8:00, and you might think half an hour, that's loads, but it might actually only be about 12 to 14 minutes of studio time, and then obviously you're just one of 2 or 3 pundits, so that time isn't all your own, and then you have to get in certain things which are you kind of have to touch on certain topics, and then post match. You can be guided by, like, if there's been a long injury delay, that could eat into your post-match talk time. So sometimes it's actually easier to do the job when you've, or it's a lot harder to do the job when you've only a minute or two to talk. Yeah. Because, first of all, you have to be, like, really disciplined and get your words right. Choose which bits are the most important. And also it's frustrating because even if your colleague who's on with you says something which you don't agree, then the presenter's already giving you a signal beforehand going, listen, there's no time for interaction here. We have to get in and out of this quite quickly, so just one answer each. So it's not like that it's scripted, it's just really restricting because of time.
Gary Lineker used to make that point, Murph. Do you remember when when Sky Sports really started upping their game and Gary Neville came into it and all that kind of stuff? There was often comparisons made with Match of the Day and how their analysis kind of lacked a lot in comparison. Now, I think they actually, it was probably fair at the time, and that they, I think the likes of Shearer actually has upped his game since then. But I do remember Gary Lineker making the point that there's actually a totally different skill. It's often a lot more difficult, as Richie says, to make a point in 90 seconds as opposed to having to get every bit of it bang on, as opposed to having, say, 5 minutes to make the same point and thrash it out a bit.
Yeah, and I think that there's a different kind of metric at play when you're dealing with RTE or BBC, which are, you know, they're networks, I suppose. You know, like they're public service broadcasting compared to Sky, where it's like, well, we can stay on air for, you know, however long the Monday Night Football show is at the moment, with, you know, two games the last couple of Mondays. It's like it started at 5 and finished at 11. You know, like the difference between that and even, you know, I would say there's, RTE have in the past had reasonably opulent schedule times for their live sport and live football. But the way Richie says it, I mean, you know, like 3/4 an hour beforehand, 1/2 an hour afterwards, it's still not as much time as maybe you think it is. But it is, because, it is interesting to watch that 15-minute clip that you just referenced there, the YouTube clip of Evra and Hasselbank, and just see how there is no limitation on what they say. Like, if they have a point they want to make, they just go ahead and make it.
But it's also the most natural way to reflect on as a match is just to have a conversation about it. And sometimes I've been in the situation loads of times, you're in the studio and it can just feel a bit stilted because everything is kind of like the presenter is like a moderator. So question to you, question to me, question to you. And it kind of just feels a bit stilted, but it's needed as well because in some cases, like if there isn't that much kind of rapport between the two pundits or they actually don't differ on anything, so it's difficult to have a conversation when you have two people who are in total sync with each other. And also obviously the presenter has to move things along and make sure you cover, you know, show the goal, show the sending off, make sure we shut up in time to go over for a live post-match interview with somebody who played a key role in the game we've just seen. So obviously the presenter has a load of important roles, and sometimes the nicest thing is just when you're just left on your own, just with whoever's on with you, and you just bounce around what you've just seen.
Yeah, and there's the, you know, the tyranny of the clip montages as well, showing us stuff that, you know, the vast majority of people have already seen already, you know, but for whatever reason, you know, it's baked into the thing now, right? At the end of the game, we have to have a full run through of all of the major highlights of a game, which is fine if it's 4-3, but if it's nil all Man United Chelsea and you're just like replaying, you know, Harry Maguire getting...
There's a challenge there. You know, I've had 1 or 2 nil-alls often involving Crystal Palace on Premier
League. Of course.
And you do, like, the problem is if you don't show clips, then you're just talking without even the aid of the clips. And I know you say everyone has already seen everything, but they haven't. People see the last 20 minutes of games, last 15 minutes. We have these conversations I often think, like, you know, if there's a goal in the first half, you should show that goal at the end of full time as well, as long as there's enough time to do it, because a good portion of the audience won't have seen it. And it is one of the main things that you want to see.
I would say that's absolutely fine. But the rules are never, you know, nothing should ever be like, you know, cut and dried, you know. And if it's a nil all draw and you're showing the same 3 or 4 chances or refereeing decisions, at some stage it's just like, okay, well, we don't have to, if the conversation is good, like, we can just burn...
Totally.
This,
you know what I mean? I agree with that. It shouldn't be formulaic. It shouldn't be like, this is the way it's done this week, and it's also done that way the next week. And, you know, you always do whatever 4 clips. I agree with you there.
Mm.
What was the point I was going to make? Oh, yeah. I was in Premier Sports teasing my own head through a lot of the points that Murph raises there about how we're going to cover the Liverpool-Sheffield United game. So I didn't actually see the United match live. Caught it on Match of the Day. And there was an interesting... At the start of the game, right, the camera zeroed in on Marcus Rashford, and Guy Mowbray was commentating, and he said he didn't get a win in Parliament, but he got the winner in Paris. And whether you agree with Marcus Rashford's causes or not, there's surely only admiration for his continued commitment to them as the Manchester United striker makes the news on and off the field. I thought, like, I'm having a pop specifically at Guy Mowbray here, but I thought the idea that a commentator feels he has to qualify his comments by saying whether you agree with Marcus Rashford's causes or not was quite striking, because presumably many viewers don't agree with poor children being fed during school holidays, and therefore the commentator doesn't want to piss them off. I don't know if I'm reading too much into that, Richie, but it just seems like it was quite striking to me when I heard that kind of little qualifier being put in there.
Yeah, that was a Match of the Day comment, so that would have been pre-recorded, so he would have had that script in his head and delivered it and sent it up, and so it would have gone through some editing process. So it's not like it's a flippant remark during a live match, which afterwards people would have gone, geez, I wonder why he said it that way. So obviously this went through some kind of an editing process, whether it was, you know, Guy Mowbray himself or his bosses. But I do think, like, just to be generous here, I assume there's the BBC impartiality kind of rules are always kind of floating in the background and these kind of an issues that, although Rashford hasn't made this a political issue at all, he's just said this is about an issue and we've enough resources and it's worth spending money on, and he's kept it as focused as that. It is become more than that in the way in which it's discussed in England. So there is obviously an unavoidable political element now, because I don't think you can have this discussion without somebody in 2 or 3 sentences time start criticising the Tory party or the government or Boris Johnson, and it becomes about them and what's wrong with them and, oh my god, we need to get them out. So it's in itself it's an issue which exactly as you phrased it, hungry kids need food, let's give it to them. Like, that seems to be an open and closed kind of case. Just do the right thing. But there's a political element to it, which I assume somebody somewhere in BBC has guarded them all against looking like they're taking sides on. Which
Rashford
is
has been amazing, though, hasn't he? I mean, he might not have got the win in Parliament, but the stuff that's been going on that he's done on his... Marcus Rashford's Twitter timeline is now one of the most...
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the most joyous things in the world in 2020, which says a lot about things that are going wrong in the world in 2020, but also says a lot about what Rashford is doing. He's just so zeroed in. Like you said, he's not getting caught up. He could easily have gotten caught up in this war of words with the Tories, and he's not. You know, he's politely arguing with them and debating with them about what he wants. He's actually actively telling people not to be piling in and making it a really toxic thing, which is almost impossible to do. But he's taking that moral high ground there. And in the meantime, he's going and actually, you know, moved it on and created this grassroots thing, which is just extraordinary.
It's been incredible. Like, first of all, to take such an interest in an issue like this is hugely commendable, and then to make it a cause of his own, not only to make such progress with it as he did, overturning a government decision a while ago, but that he's remained above the fairly toxic kind of debate that's going on at the moment. And maybe I'm just looking at the online stuff. Actually, it's quite uncivilized in Parliament as well. They were calling each other scum or something, weren't they, at one point? The MPs. So, like, he's just floated above it all and just said, like, this is a cause, this is an issue, and we can afford to do it, so let's do it. So I assume there's loads of people and opposition parties or PR people saying, you know, there's an opportunity here for us. If we can get Marcus to back our cause or get our guy in a photo with him. And he stayed, I'm sure he's had umpteen requests for people to kind of associate themselves with him or for Marcus to look as if he's now like a Labour voter or an anti-Tory person. And he's just sidestepped all of those landmines. So, which of course keeps even more integrity on his side with what he's trying to achieve.
We are going to have Champions League coverage during the week on the World Service. We're also talking GAA tomorrow, I believe, Murph, with Oisin and Andy Moore, who's going to be becoming a more and more familiar voice on the World Service over the next couple of months.
Yes, Andy is going to be joining us for the next... Well, how long does this championship last? Till the 19th of December? Is that the All-Ireland football final?
A lot of fingers being crossed around the country there, Murph, but I believe so.
Yeah, well, if it all goes ahead, we'll have the rather surreal prospect of an All-Ireland final in Christmas week, and Andy Moran will be with us here on Second Captains for the duration of the championship, however long it lasts.
Excellent.
So if you want to hear Andy and Oisin to get the dream team, Oisin at number 12, Andy in his usual spot on the edge of the square. I just loved how they linked up last week. So let's see how this baby rides.
Secondcaptains.com.
secondcaptains.com/join and join the party.
Also, we have heard back from the Tim Robbins camp. Academy Award winner Tim Robbins really enjoyed the interview with Ken, we're told by his people. So there you go. Well done to Ken on that, and well done to Tim Robbins.
And Hollywood PAs, they never say shit like that unless they really mean it. So.
Jonathan Wilson is going to be on the show today to talk about the European Premier League and also the possibility of that happening. Also his old journalistic colleague, Kevin McCara. Kevin was a really nice guy, really well-respected football writer. You would have read him in the Irish Times a lot as well, as Guardian stuff was printed there. He's died aged 62 of Alzheimer's disease, and Jonathan's written a lovely tribute about him. He's part of a movement, as Jonathan says, part of a movement in the era of, what do you say, in the era of fever pitch, fanzines and Italian football on Channel 4. Kevin was one of those who transformed football journalism. Out went the jaded hackery of old, and in came a far more literary sensibility. So we will talk about that. We'll talk to you, Richie, about Shamrock Rovers, I think maybe later on in the show, but I've got an email to read.
I've got a call here. It says, you're the most boring, predictable, condescending interviewer around. Go back to lecturing. You have the charisma of a sick bag.
Oh, God.
That's just it. I just mentioned, not you, no me.
Okay, ain't nobody f***ing with my click, 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 click. Ain't nobody fresher than my mom.
We don't normally broadcast all the stuff that comes from scum around the country. Click.
Our scumbag today is Aoife Spillane Hinks, who says, dear folks at Second Captains, I hope you're all doing very well. My husband, John Duddy, the neurosurgeon, not the boxer. Absolutely adore. You remember John Doddingmurph?
I do.
He was in Touch in the past. Absolutely adores.
Didn't
your
he get
show.
Absolutely slated by Kev?
Yeah, there was a bit of stuff going on there. We knew by the content of John Doddy's email that it was probably the neurosurgeon and not the boxer who had gotten in touch with us. It was very highfalutin stuff. But
as I recall, it was the neurosurgeon versus neurologist beef. The age-old neurologist neurosurgeon beef.
That sounds like it. It seems to always be playing when he's in the house, and he basically only drinks from the second captain's mug that I got him last Christmas. He had a feud with you all regarding neurosurgery versus football back in the spring, which delighted him no end. Again, feud with Ken, and it might have been neurosurgery versus neurology. Maybe football was brought in there as well. I can't remember. Mm. Anyway, John is turning 40 on November 1st. For the first time in his life, he had actually wanted to throw a birthday party for himself, but obviously that can't happen with COVID. Would you ever consider giving him a shout out on the podcast sometime between now and his birthday? Listen, I'm sure you get a million requests like this, so I understand if it's not possible, but it would absolutely make his day to hear something like that on the podcast. Thanks so much for your fantastic work. Though I'm not a big sport follower, I've listened to a number of episodes of the main show, and I'm an avid listener to Where Is George Gibney. Thanks also for considering this request. All the best, Aoife. Aoife, that could be the most polite email we've ever received. It's a class above the usual scumbags you get. Scumbag is a compliment, by the way, Aoife. I know you don't listen to all the shows, but just in case. It's a good thing to be
that
a scumbag.
We've called you a scumbag.
Yeah. I hope you take it that way. Otherwise,
I think, you know, like, we, you know, okay, that's a shout out. I appreciate that. I mean, maybe is the rule only that if we have been engaged in a feud with you in that calendar year, you're allowed dead ask for a shout out. Is that the rule?
Yeah, that sounds fair enough. Shout out has been delivered to John Doddy. I feel your pain, John. I too was supposed to be celebrating my 40th birthday and that got called off. The birthday didn't get called off, but the celebrations did. So hope you have a great day and you should enjoy your drink of choice out of that second captain's mug of yours. We should probably give a shout out to John Doddy, the boxer as well, I suppose, Murph, should we?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
We love John Doddy. I mean, he's probably our second favourite Irish middleweight of the third millennium. But hey, you know, what are you going to do? It's still solidly top three, John. Can't say fairer than that.
Jonathan Wilson is ready to go. Jonathan, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. How are you?
Not bad. I want to ask where you stand on this Evra versus Hasselbank debate. Essentially, the question at the root of it was whether this is a good point for Chelsea and also understandable for Manchester United to be a bit more cautious given their recent travails against Tottenham, or was this 22 scared footballers too petrified to come out and play a proper game of football?
I guess I'd err towards the former. I mean, it seems to me there's sort of the difference between the two sides is Chelsea have had all this problem defending, and we've talked about that a lot, and they've kept two clean sheets in the past week, so great. That is clearly something that they've looked at and they've begun to put right. I think personnel helps. You know, Mendy clearly is not the sort of the jittery bag of nerves that Kepa is, and that helps. And he made three very good saves on Saturday. I thought Thiago Silva was very authoritative. So the personnel has worked. The switch to the back three, which he also did in the cup semi-final, and it worked then. And they got the win then. I don't want to say it's entirely because of United's individual errors, but certainly individual errors helped. And they might have got a win on Saturday if he got the penalty that they should have done. So I think there's been a conscious effort on the part of Lampard to tighten things up. And two clean sheets in two games, that suggests things are going well in that regard. And the next step is to try and meld onto that the attacking fluency they've previously had. Now, Lampard said something on Saturday after the game, which would worry me slightly, when he said that if you look at the front five we've got, they will score goals. And that's true. And maybe he was just sort of saying that, yeah, we don't have to worry about that. We've seen how good they are. I get that. It did concern me slightly in that I think what differentiates the very, very best managers from the next tier down is their capacity to organise a coherent attacking structure. And Lampard didn't seem to be addressing the possible need to do that. But maybe he just didn't want to go into that detail. So from Chelsea's point of view, this is a step in the right direction. I think from United's point of view, it just carries on a pattern. And this slightly diminishes Chelsea's achievement. That, okay, 0-0 at Old Trafford, brilliant. Clean sheet, brilliant. But this is a United side that hasn't won a home now for five games in a row. This is a United side that's lost its last game 6-1. The game before that, 3-1 at Crystal Palace. And what we've seen over and over again with Solskjaer and the recurring criticism of him is an inability to organise a team from an attacking point of view to break down deep-lying opponents. And that's why, you know, they won the last 10 away games. Brilliant. When teams come at them, they can hit the space behind them. When teams sit deep, as Chelsea did, they really struggle for creativity. And if you looked at that first 20 minutes on Saturday, again and again, Fred was doing it, McTominay was doing it, Maguire was doing it, hitting these long diagonals in front of Daniel James on the left. But there was no in front of Daniel James on the left. There was Reece James was just sitting there and gobbling it up. And the odd time that he came forward, you had Aspilicueta covering across. And Xavi did stop for 20 minutes or so, but their response to that was then just to keep playing the ball sideways. And if you think of the four chances they had, one was Jorginho losing the ball in a dangerous position, so they could get the counter. So the Rashford chance was saved by Mendy's feet. There was the Cavani little jab in at the near post, which was just Cavani, you know, making space for himself to get on a cross, so sort of a little bit of improvisation. And the other two were snapshots, one from Rashford, one from Mata. So United essentially didn't really create anything from a cohesive move in the whole game. And so that just plays out again, this big problem we've seen with Solskjaer since he got the job.
Well, this is the kind of football that could be seen on a more regularly on a European level, Jonathan, if this European Premier League ends up being anything more than just sort of a bargaining chip or a pie in the sky idea. We didn't get a chance to talk about it last week. You wrote a piece about it at the weekend, that, or over the last few days, that is essentially, I think you're, in a way, you're saying, let them at it. This could be the best of a few bad solutions for the wealth inequality in the game at present.
Yeah, I mean, I say that with a lot of reservations. And I should say that I don't think this European Premier League is anywhere close to happening. I think this is essentially a bargaining position for when the Champions League restructuring happens for 2024-5. But that's actually what I think is worrying. So there's sort of two sort of prongs to that piece that I wrote on Sunday. And the first was just sort of say, well, maybe I'm coming at it from a very sort of biased point of view, that my experience of football growing up was watching Sunderland and being very partisan about Sunderland, and maybe even now that infects me. So the thing that alarmed me about Project Big Picture, and I think Ken touched on this actually, that it was, if you were a smaller club, if you were like a Fleetwood or an Accrington or whoever, you probably looked at that and thought, great, we get £3 or £4 million straight away and that'll keep us going. And we don't care if the Premier League's unbalanced. We're not going to be in the Premier League. But for teams like Sunderland, who, okay, have been rubbish for 4 or 5 years, but still have aspirations of getting in the Premier League and maybe doing something there, it would have been devastating, because it would have said, even if you get in the Premier League, the top six are going to be so far ahead of you that you can't touch them. So I sort of thought, well, what would a Super League look like, and would I be able to tolerate watching it? Is that just my sort of Sunderland bias stopping me seeing this as a good thing? And I sort of thought, well, the IPL, you know, the Indian Premier League cricket,
yeah,
I watch every day. I love it. It's sort of, but I don't actually know anything about it. I just sort of watch it because it's great cricket. And if you ask me who's top of the table, I think it's Mumbai Indians, but I'm not entirely certain. I know that there's a couple of slightly odd results over the weekend. I know Kings XI Punjab, who notionally in my team are fifth, but have got a chance of getting in the playoffs. But it's not like I'm sort of following the ebbs and flows as closely as I do football. And that's not just because I work in football. That's because I just don't care that much. And I really wonder if people do care about franchises. But maybe for the sport itself, that doesn't matter. The Indian Premier League is clearly some of the greatest cricket that's ever been played. And so if you're trying to... if you're asking what is good for the sport, if you're not thinking about money, what is good for the sport? Do you want to gather all the best players at a handful of clubs and let them play against each other, and the level of sport is magnificent and you have this great spectacle? The IPL is a way of doing it. Or you think, spread out the talent as far as you reasonably can, and those to clubs that sort of represent their towns or their villages or their cities or their regions, and it's actually meaningful. And those seem to me two ends of a spectrum which are not necessarily that easy to reconcile. But the worst of all worlds is some kind of compromise somewhere in the middle, where you have a load of really rich teams and a load of much poorer teams in the same division. And so you get these massive disparities of resource within the same game. And so the games become no longer contests. And I the Premier League clearly isn't as far down that route as as other European leagues, as, you know, as France or as Italy or as Spain or as Germany. But it's getting there. And Project Big Picture or increased revenue for the teams who are in the Champions League through a restructuring would increase that. So rather than an even more distorted Premier League, I think probably it'd be better just to separate them off and say, all right, if you're going to keep talking about this, go and do it and see if it works.
Yeah. Because a lot of the focus is on whether it would work or not and what it would be like. And, you know, do we want to see these teams play each other in a European Premier League time and time again? But, I mean, the other side of it, which you've touched on there, is probably more interesting. What are they leaving behind? And what would it necessarily be a total disaster for English league football to not have those teams? I mean, yes, financially, I'm sure, and for some other reasons. But you could end up with a really interesting kind of... a genuinely unpredictable league with a load of teams who still play pretty high standard football, still plenty of money sloshing about to buy decent players, and yet you know could just be a slightly fairer situation all around.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things you've touched on there. So one, if they are siphoned off into a league, how would that work? You know, the IPL works, I think, and I might be wrong about this, but sort of an instinctive sense of it is it works because it takes 2 months. It's very sort of compressed. And there's only 8 franchises, and they tried with 10 and they tried with 9, but they went back to 8 because that concentrates the quality, and it also means teams don't get cast adrift. So every game, I mean, occasionally one team will fall off the bottom, but for most games are meaningful. Most teams can qualify for those playoffs. If you were trying to find a competition to run over 9 months with 16 teams and limited or no relegation, I think that'd be a much harder... be harder to find a meaningful structure. The other point, I think you would want to put in place some kind of restrictions. Now, whether that's a salary cap, which I would want to see proper research into this. My instincts are salary caps are not necessarily helpful, but you would want to make sure that the distribution of revenue is much more even than it is at the minute. So the revenue presumably coming through TV broadcasts, but also probably league sponsorship, that kind of thing. At the minute in the Premier League, the top team gets 1.7 times as much as the bottom, which isn't too bad. It's just that's then exacerbated by the fact the top teams are playing in Europe and also, you know, they generate more money from commercial activities. So you'd want to find a way of sort of keeping that relatively, keeping an equilibrium there. But, you know, the word you said there that immediately sort of I thought, yeah, that's a word we should take for granted, was financially. And actually, maybe we shouldn't be thinking about this in financial terms. Maybe we should be thinking, and yeah, I know this is sort of utopian, but maybe as long as clubs got the finances to keep going, maybe we shouldn't be thinking about people making profits. And if you actually look at the Championship and League One and League Two and the National League, crowds are higher now than they've been for 60 years. And the tragedy of modern English football is that's still not enough to survive. Mm. The clubs are still dying, despite putting on a product that is attracting more people to go to the stadium. Obviously not now, but pre-COVID, attracting more fans than ever before. So the product itself, people want to go and watch it. And I would assume that in a reformed Division One or whatever we call it, if that could be sort of Championship Plus, you know, all the sort of the thrill of a Championship, of the unpredictability of a Championship, but with, you know, 14 bigger clubs and better, you know, better players, that seems to me quite an attractive proposition.
Okay, well, we'll give people a chance to think about that. I do want to talk to you about another piece you wrote, which was a lovely tribute, I have to say, Jonathan, to Kevin McCara, a colleague, friend of yours, who passed away. Guardian football writer. I mentioned his brilliant writing was also printed in the Irish Times, so people will be familiar with Kevin also from radio contributions that he's made over the years. You said he's a pioneer who changed Scottish football journalism, but most fundamentally, he was a thoroughly nice man.
Yeah, and if you look at the responses on Twitter and not below the line in the Guardian comments yesterday, there's sort of three words leap out over and over again, which are gentle, kind, nice. I think if that's what people think about you when you've gone, that's a pretty good life you've lived. And you know, there's a load of people got in touch with me or in those replies. A load of people who work at The Guardian now saying that they remember when they came into the Guardian on their first day, and they sort of saw Kevin sitting at the desk, and were sort of, oh God, it's Kevin McCarra, and he would make sure he wandered over and talked to them and introduced himself and made them feel at home. So he was very welcoming. He was very aware of other people and how they may be feeling. He had a great love of football. You know, he was a football journalist mainly because he loved football, and particularly Celtic. But I think the great thing about that was that although he was a massive Celtic fan, he was never partisan with it. You know, he could see Celtic's failings, and you know, he could appreciate good stuff from Rangers. And I don't think any Rangers fans would ever have had any sort of reason to be aggrieved by him. But I then sort of, having seen all this stuff about his niceness, I then sort of thought, I really hope people don't forget what a great writer he was. And I have to say, I hadn't appreciated how revolutionary he was in Scotland. That, you know, I've known he'd been ill for several years. But you know, I'd sort of started to put the tribute together 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I knew the end was close, and so I spoke to some people in Scotland, and I sort of hadn't appreciated that when he, you know, he was given the job by Scotland Sunday when it launched in 1988. And he really was at the forefront of that movement, along with fanzines and, you know, Italian football on Channel 4 and Fever Pitch, of transforming what football media was. That he took it from being this very cliched, jaded form of journalism, and he invested it with a literary sensibility. That he just sort of wrote about it as he thought about it. And he came from an academic background. He'd worked, he'd set up a publisher, so he published Edwin Morgan, so you know, working with really sort of big poets. He published Sonnets from Scotland, which came out in 1984. The cover of that was designed by Alistair Gray. So, you know, these were big names he was working with. And then he just sort of drifts into football journalism and is brilliant at that, and transforms that landscape. So he was a pioneer, but I sort of didn't really know any of that. I just sort of knew him as a really nice bloke who's a really good writer who absolutely loved football.
That sounds like a fairly unusual path into. You said he kind of just fell into football journalism from this literary, academic sort of poetry background. How did he end up becoming a football writer?
So he was doing a PhD at the University of Glasgow, placing Robert Henryson, the 15th century Scottish poet, in a European context. And he was getting increasingly disillusioned with academia. You say it's quite unusual. This is exactly my background as well, that I got disillusioned with academia and didn't quite get around to doing my PhD. But which might be why I got on with him so well.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a lovely story. Susan, his wife, told me that he'd been at The Guardian. I'll go back to what I was saying before, but sure. He'd been at The Guardian a few years. And he's in the office and he gets a call up from reception. Kevin, there's a Dr. Lyle here to see you. And he thinks, oh shit, it's my PhD supervisor. He's tracked me down at last. Because he'd never formally quit the PhD. So he sort of sheepishly goes downstairs, like, God, how do I approach this? How do I apologize to this guy who I abandoned 20 years ago? And Dr. Lyle apparently says, oh, Kevin, thank God you gave up that academic nonsense and did something with your life. So it was all fine.
Brilliant.
But he'd been working for, I think it's called The Third Eye, an art centre in Glasgow, doing some part-time work there while he did his PhD. And they put on an exhibition of Scottish football history. And so the contact he made through that, and he then wrote a book off the back of the exhibition. The exhibition, I think, was hugely popular. He wrote a book called A Pictorial History of Scottish Football, which is, I guess, a load of photos that were in the exhibition, or photos of items that were in the exhibition. And Kevin sort of has written the narrative around that. And from that, he started doing some work for a magazine called Scottish Field. And that sort of brought him to the attention of Scotland on Sunday when they were launching in 88. And that, you know, that's when he sort of committed to football journalism full time.
He has been, he's been ill for quite a while. He's had Alzheimer's. People might remember, they may or they may not, but during Euro 2016, he went missing and there was this big search. I remember being a big thing. I think he was actually found, I guess, through Twitter. There was like an appeal, and an England fan found him back then, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, that was a terrible thing. You know, I'd sort of, I think we'd known towards the end of The Guardian. So his last piece for The Guardian was 2012. I think he formally left the paper in 2013, but you know, his last piece was sort of October 2012. And I think we'd sort of known that something wasn't quite right, but nobody quite knew what was going on. And I did an event with him in Edinburgh in 2015, and it was obvious. I personally had a lot of experience of Alzheimer's, and I was pretty sure what it was without being a doctor. But and that was the early stages in 2016, because he was he was still going to games. He still went to Celtic and Partick Thistle. Because he just loved football. I mean, he actually is the house he lived in at the end is right next door to Neil Lennon and over the road from Steven Gerrard. He's right at the heart of Glaswegian football.
Right, brilliant.
He obviously knew Neil Lennon very well. And those sort of big name Scottish players and players he played in Scotland and managers in the 90s. You know, their memories of him the respect they clearly held him in. Is obvious. So he went to Giro 2016 with his wife, and they were staying in Avignon. And I think he spent a lot of time in Avignon during the World Cup in 98. So I assume that's why they went back there. But obviously, a great historic city, and Kevin being who he was, that would have been a great interest to him. All the papacy and or anti-papacy and all that stuff. I don't really know what happened, but he ended up sort of wandering out of the hotel and not being able to find his way back. And I was in Paris at the time, and I remember getting a call from Susan, from his wife, saying, "Yeah, Kevin's gone missing. Can you sort of tweet about it?" And so this sort of pathetic sense of helplessness of kind of just tweeting out saying, "Please try and find him," and not really sure, not really being sure how much you should say about kind of the illness. And I think it was a sign of the affection in which he was held that. Sort of every journalist, every football figure was desperately sort of sending out tweets, sending out messages on Facebook, sort of saying, "Please look for him. This is his picture. If you see him, be aware he might be confused, but please help him." And then, he was found, I think it was about 24 hours later, an England fan who'd seen the picture on Twitter, found him actually quite close to the hotel, just sort of in a back street. And he was a bit sunburned and dehydrated and very confused, but thankfully, he was okay. And actually, a similar thing happened a year or so later in an art gallery in Manchester. He went missing, and there was an appeal in Manchester Evening News, and he was found. So, Susan had to curtail, I think, the sort of the trips out there, which obviously diminished his quality of life. But the last couple of years, I mean, I went up to see him last year, and he was in a bad, bad way.
Yeah.
62 is, it's no age. It's really sad.
Well, Jonathan, some lovely words there. People can read your piece. We appreciate you chatting to us about him today, and we'll let you go there. Thanks a million.
Cheers, thanks.
From Ireland's second captain show.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. Protein.
This is not a dig at football people who know the game.
No respect, no honour.
What's the respect of my day?
The dog shit is bad on.
But who plays rugby?
I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
No, they don't.
They do.
Sorry, on. They do not.
And the balls.
Shut up, the two of you. I just want to play commentary at a goal.
Far up and I go.
And they still don't.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down, you create excitement, you win balls when you shouldn't win balls, you commit yourself to the game.
Couple of things we want to mention before we wrap up this Bank Holiday Monday podcast. Patrick Bamford's hat-trick against Villa, including that amazing third goal where he dribbled past a defender in a phone box, that lad.
Yeah, that's exactly what he did. I mean, that's a phone box-sized area of football field.
That four Aston Villa defenders in that phone box. Not a bother to Bamford. Unbelievable.
Sign him up.
And the other point is Shamrock Rovers are League of Ireland champions after... Bohemians were beaten by Finn Harps. I see Emmett Malone, Richie, said that it might not have been the way that anyone at Shamrock Rovers would have chosen to clinch the club's 18th league title, but as next best things go, they'd probably take a home defeat for Bohemians by a side struggling to avoid relegation.
Yeah, I mean, nothing this season has gone as clubs would like to have them to go. I mean, if you go back to the discussions that were taking place about how and why should you try and restart the league, one of the fears that a lot of the clubs had, this is probably more directed at the clubs who were mid-table or bottom of the table, that were fearing that, you know, a run of it in such a shortened season that you might not end up where you deserve. You might end up getting relegated or in a playoff relegation after a bad few run of results or a few injuries or a few bad decisions. But nobody anywhere can question whether Shamrock Rovers deserve to be champions. They've been far and above all the others. Bohemians briefly looked like they were put in a challenge at this just after the restart, but that petered away. So deserve a champions. So they, I don't think they, I haven't been in touch with anyone since over the weekend, but I'm actually working on the game on Wednesday. I think they're playing Derry and Tala, so I assume they're absolutely delighted. It's fully deserved.
Yeah, no, get the thing over with now as well. I mean, four games still to go, which is almost a quarter of their season. They played 14 matches, won 12 and drawn 2. Can't really argue with that. Strange circumstances, but you can't really put an asterisk beside them. I mean, they've obviously been the best team by a mile, right?
Oh, they have, yeah. I mean, it's been a kind of a curious, and it's, I suppose, it's not that odd in League of Ireland terms, but like Cork City getting relegated only 3 years ago, they were champions. I mean, that in most of the leagues, that would stand out. In the League of Ireland, it just kind of seemed like over the last 10 or 20 years, we've come used to seeing teams do really, really well and then be followed by a period where they really, really struggle. And the challenge that Rovers would have set, like go back 4 years when Bradley took the job, it was like, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years, we want to end up as champions. But the task then would have been, like, how do we topple Dundalk? How do we get above Cork City? Like, Cork and Dundalk are setting standards. They're quite a bit away from everyone else. Off the field, on the field, their budgets, everything. And Cork have just kind of imploded in that time. And Dundalk this season in particular have had a huge amount of difficulties off the pitch as well as the obvious ones we've seen on it. So slight little kind of, just from an objective, neutral, distant observer, you think I would love to see just how good this Rovers team could be by having a really, really good battle at the top with a really, really good team to see if they could push them all the way, which isn't at all to try and take away that Rovers deserved it and that even if they had a battle from 10 other teams that they wouldn't still finish on top. But that's the only little thing. I mean, it's remarkable in a season that only has 18 games that they've won it with 4 games to spare.
Okay, guys, I've gotten through this with no cramp. Let's wrap this up right now before things go due south. Thanks, Richie.
Mind yourself. Cheers.
Thanks, Murph.
Thanks, Richie. Thanks, Owen.
Thanks, cheers, everybody. Murph. We'll chat to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuaders of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.